She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And thank you so much for joining us today. This show is sponsored by Chapman Tucson. I'd like to thank them for their support and for what they are doing for their part to make a fabulous green team happen and doing good things for the planet. I love my tagline, we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And if ever there was a topic that every living human being needs to think about in this day and age, it is climate change. We have another important guest, a man who is arguably one of the world's greatest living geoscientists with a very big mission in his life, educating the world about climate change, not just scientists, but the world. We're very pleased to welcome Dr. Wallace Brecker, a.k.a. Wally, to his friends. And since I got to meet him once, I'm going to call him Wally. Wally, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
It's a pleasure.
You've got an important message, the most important, when we talked off air a little bit. And I have one brief announcement about a national sponsor, and then we'll go on with the show. And as I say each week, EcoBella is an important part of the whole process of what we're doing as a planet. It's June. It's a time when people go outside, they go hiking and camping, and they go to the beach. And my caution to all of you, make sure that you protect your skin and your family's skin from the sun when you're spending too much time outside. Read the ingredients in your products to make sure that you're not doing more harm than good because of the harsh chemicals in many of them. It's all part of one global community. Take the time to worry about what you're purchasing and look at it, and then you don't have to worry anymore. Mrs. Green's favorite product from EcoBella. I use an age antidote day cream with SPF 15 because I'm going to be 63. Check them out, www.ecobella.com. And to me, it is very important to support companies like them for our health and the health of the planet. Now let's get started with our show and our guest. As I said, I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Wallace Brecker, a.k.a. Wally. He is one of the world's greatest living geoscientists. And I just want to read one little sentence from a bio. There's, believe me, a great deal written about Wally. For more than half a century, his major research interest has been the ocean's role in climate change. He was among the pioneers in radiocarbon and isotope dating, the quintessential process for creating maps of the Earth's past climate fluctuations since as early as the Pleistocene age. He was also the first person to ever recognize the ocean conveyor belt, which, by the way, he named, and I did find that out when he met him, arguably the most important discovery in the history of oceanography and its critical relation to climates. So, Wally, welcome. I have many questions, and I have worked really hard to make sure they're up to, you know, worthy of your time, because you have really important things to say. But I think it's great if we start out with the very simple for, we have a mainstream audience. And what is your definition of climate change that's ever occurring? And historically, the red flags you've been seeing for a long, long time about global warming?
Well, we know that every day the Earth, in a sense, has to balance its income of sunlight by getting rid of, you know, the same amount of energy in Earthlight. And that loss is impeded by what we call greenhouse gases. The queen of greenhouse gases is water vapor. But CO2 and methane and nitrous oxide are also greenhouse gases. And what they do is when units of Earthlight go up through the atmosphere, they can get captured by these gases. And this capture is sort of instantaneous, followed by an instantaneous emission of the same amount of energy. the reason they make a difference is that half of those emissions go back toward the Earth and only half go toward outer space. So the fact that greenhouse gases intercept some of the Earth light that's going out, the Earth has to compensate by getting warmer and therefore, you know, shoot out even more things, more of these units of Earth light, and to overcome the interference by these greenhouse gases. So we've been, you know, starting 150 years ago, started to burn carbon as a way to get our energy, and that's gone on and on and on. Today we get 15%, I mean 85% of our total energy on the planet from burning coal, oil, and natural gas. And so we're pouring CO2, one of these greenhouse gases, into the atmosphere, and it's accumulating. When I was in graduate school, there were about 310 parts per million CO2 in the air, and just recently Hawaii reached, the station at Hawaii recorded a full day of slightly more than 400. So CO2 has increased in my lifetime, you know, more than 90 parts or 110 parts per million.
Go ahead. Well, when a news article comes out like that and it's headlines in the New York Times, you have been studying it for almost half a century. What kind of impact? I mean, that was a wake-up call. It wasn't buried somewhere on the fourth page of a science journal. Everybody that I knew was talking about it to me because I'm Mrs. Green, and what does that mean? But are there any wake-up calls that impact the change in behavior when something like that is published that you have seen in your, you've got a long history? Are people starting to get a little bit worried and then therefore having their actions follow the implications of what's going to happen if we don't wake up?
Well, people have a short memory. I mean, Sandy jogged our awareness that climate could make big trouble. And, you know, that wanes. So the 400 parts per million come along, people perk up, but they go back to their ordinary way of life. The problem is that this is such a huge enterprise to do anything about it that's significant. In order to stop CO2 from increasing in the atmosphere, we not only have to cut emissions, we have to cut them by a factor of 10. And then the atmosphere at that level would stay the same as it was. So it's a huge, huge job, and I don't think anybody in the world has foggiest idea of how it can be accomplished. Of course, what we're headed for is a utopia where our energy comes mainly from the sun, wind, tides, you know, renewable energy, and probably some nuclear. But what's happened is that, let's say, in 1990, we released as a world 20 billion tons of CO2 to the atmosphere. So 20 in 1990. Last year it was 32. So we're not even leveling off. We're continuing to pour more and more and more each year beyond what we put in last year. And so eventually we've got to sort of flatten out and start down. You may want to ask about, you know, what we might do in what I would consider to be a 50-year interval, on that order between where we are now and actually achieving utopia, where we're weaned off of fossil fuels. and that's going to be.
You know,
yeah.
It is one of the questions that I want to ask you. But a little bit before that is, you know, burning fossil fuels is bad. And when I heard you speak when you were here at the U of A and in my journey of Mrs. Green, there are many, many renewable sources already available. There are alternative sources. And I just have to ask this question, even though it wasn't in the script. Is money the driver? Because we are really, you see oil companies making billions of dollars in profits. So is the problem as insurmountable as it's presented, or is money and, you know, simply a barrier? They don't want to convert to things that won't return on investment the same that pumping oil, that fracking, that compressed natural gas, all of those things bring so easily at a great cost to the earth, if you ask me. So is one of the reasons why truly that we don't have the money, or that we don't want to spend the money? There's a big difference to me.
Well, we should really think about it, that we're using the atmosphere as a garbage can for CO2. And we learn with, you know, with garbage itself and sewage that we put into rivers, that we can't continue to do that. So in the case of garbage and sewage, we learn to take care of it, to put it in some proper place or treat it. So we could do that with CO2. We can't capture it all at the source, but we could perhaps pull it back out of the atmosphere and bury it. And if we're ever to get to this, we have to put the true price on carbon. We're only being charged now for the, you know, mining of coal and transport of coal and so forth. We're not paying the price to capture it and put it away. So if the world had its head screwed on right, we would be paying that cost and starting to capture and store CO2. And of course, that extra cost on carbon would give an advantage to fledgling, you know, wind power and solar power companies. Now, their product costs, well, various estimates, but, you know, at least a factor of 50% more than fossil fuel.
And solar is getting better. I mean, the price here, at least, especially in the Southwest, is coming down to where it is a viable alternative. But when you say the real cost for extracting CO2 emissions from the atmosphere, bringing it down and burying it, even before that, there are huge oil subsidies. I mean, it's. I wake up and I think, do I live in a world where we're really not charging oil companies, not charging even the consumer for what the real cost of delivering it is, and of getting coal, you know, power from the Navajo Reservation to Los Angeles, the water that it uses. I mean, we're really not paying for it, and even the oil and gas companies aren't paying for it. So there's the extraction piece, but then there's the reality of what profit there is truly in burning dirty coal. Is that something you agree with?
Well, I mean, you know, the lobbies for the fossil fuel industry are very powerful, and they're going to try to hold on to all of these things, same way the farmers have and anybody who gets, you know, money back from the federal government. If, you know, our leaders really wanted to solve this problem, they'd start to think about all of this, but the political will isn't there since 2008, when before that, I think we're on the right track, that more and more greater percentage of people were accepting that it was a serious problem. And then the oil companies, the Koch brothers, and various people started this incredibly effective campaign to tar us and say that we don't know what we're talking about and it really isn't a serious problem. And we, on the other side, have not proven very effective in countering this. And they're willing to, you know, use deceit and all kinds of things. And especially scientists try to be honest. And so it's an unfair battle in that they can use tactics that we refuse to use.
It's really, really, really out of whack. I mean, it truly is. One of the things that frustrates me in this journey now, which is a good frustration, is what I call the integration of thought, which you have had. And I want to segue a little bit to the impact on the oceans, because believe it or not, I think people think, well, there's global warming, and they're not connecting its absolutely systemic, pervasive impact on every aspect of our life. So you have lots of information, research, knowledge about ocean acidification and the impact that carbon emissions and climate change has on the oceans. And I think that gets people's attention. They love to fish. They love to eat fish. They love to use the oceans as a recreational opportunity. So can you talk a little bit about your you know, you did biochemical, the cycles of carbon and the influence on the polar ice and ocean sediments. You have international attention about that. Talk about the state of our oceans. That's one of the scariest topics
you know,
out there.
The other side of global warming is ocean acidification. I may disappoint you in saying this, but I think that that's a lesser problem. I mean, the two go together. Of course, the worse it gets on land, the worse it's going to get on sea. But I think that the actual damage that can be done at sea for a long, long time is a hell of a lot less than it's going to happen on land or, you know, on ice-covered oceans. One of my fears is that as we heat up the ocean, we heat it from top to bottom gradually. So to heat up the bottom is going to take hundreds of years. In the meantime, the upper ocean will get warmer, and that changes the extent of stratification. And it's stratification impedes the return of nitrogen and phosphorus, which are essential to plant growth. Ocean organisms are feeding on what works its way up through this stratification and gets to, you know, the sunlit part where plants can grow. So we may, as we warm the ocean, we may change that in such a way that it will cut down plant production and hence everything else in the ocean. A very difficult problem, and, you know, it's the ocean is in the way it operates is really complex, and so there is no easy way to figure out what, you know, what's going to happen. Roger Revelle, who was one of the pioneers in all this, he was at that time director of Scripps Oceanographic. He said that what we're doing is man's or humankind's greatest geophysical experiment. And indeed it is. One of the problems, we just can't accurately predict any of the things we would like to know. How much storminess is going to increase, how much the intensity of storms are going to increase, how much food production is going to be changed. And of course, that's one of the big concerns, that warming will reduce the yields of grain across the world. So all of these things, you know, we have some ideas about them, but our ability to predict them is very limited. And therefore, we're going to find out a whole bunch of stuff by doing Revelle's experiment. And of course, we know the experiment's going to be done. We're going to experience considerably higher amounts of CO2 in the atmosphere because we're hooked on fossil fuels, and it's going to take a long time to get unhooked, and, you know, we're not being very effective.
No, and it's we're kind of like we are the lab rats. I hate to say it like that, but you're right. It is the human experience, and we have no idea. What I want to ask you, and I wanted to ask you this when I saw you, is At what point, and if we have to go to break, I'll remember and we'll come back to this, but at what point did there become any question in the political arena, when it got into that arena, whether it's man, the number of people inhabiting the planet and what we're doing with it is cause for the acceleration versus people, I think, in very, very dwindling numbers, hopefully, are saying, you know, we've always had cycles. I don't say it in my presence much anymore, yeah. But there's cycles. We've never had this many billion people on the planet consuming in the way that we are and burning the fossil fuels that we're doing. How do you respond to that, or do you even bother?
Well, I'm thinking about it. That was a complicated question. Say it again.
Well, no, people...
Briefly.
I know. It's like I went off on a little tangent there because of my beliefs. So people say it's really not accelerated climate change because of what we are doing as human beings. Climate change has always occurred. So,
okay.
You know what I mean? So,
let's stop there. I get what you want.
And we have to go to a break. So you'll get time to think about a really good answer in a minute. We have to take a very short break. And let me just tell my guests again, if they just joined us, we are having a wonderful conversation with Dr. Wally Brecker, who is the world's leading geoscientist, one of the greatest living geoscientists with a very big mission in his life, educating the world about climate change and what we can do about. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. We want you to stay here with us, and when we come back, we'll talk about the political conversation of climate change and then get into some of the other solutions that Wally has talked about and is famous for. Please stay here with me.
Can you predict the future? The reality is we can't, but we can be ready for it. Funded by the National Science Foundation, researchers at the University of Arizona are working on a $3 million project to study the monsoon and learn about our changing desert weather, climate, and ecology. Such knowledge will help guide us to a more sustainable future, not just for our desert, but for the world. Now that's thinking ahead. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green. The 2013 VW Jetta TDI is the sedan people love to love. It comes with a zippy turbocharged diesel engine that's 90% cleaner burning than previous diesel engines, and it goes farther on a tank of gas than a Toyota Prius. Chapman Volkswagen has a great selection of Jetta TDIs, so choose yours today at ChapmanTucson.com or in person at 4646 East 22nd Street in Tucson.
You can always find things around the house to give to Goodwill, but I have a bigger reason to give. My brother, Jim. When Jim was just 6 weeks old, he had a stroke. He had to rewire his brain to do most things we all take for granted. Thanks to Goodwill, Jim has a job and a sense of purpose. You know how they say your donation to Goodwill changes lives? Well, it's true. Goodwill is the best thing that ever happened to Jim. Please donate today.
Go deep underwater without getting wet. Study bugs like a real scientist. Make your shadow move in colors. These are just three reasons to visit the exciting hands-on new exhibits at the Children's Museum Tucson, the region's only museum just for kids. For 25 years, we've ignited kids' imaginations at the Children's Museum Tucson. That's something to celebrate. And admission is only $2 on the first Sunday and on the 25th of each month this whole year. Children's Museum Tucson, where imagination and learning connect.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And we certainly have a wonderful guest that's giving us lots to think about today. His name is Dr. Wallace Brecker. He is arguably one of the world's greatest living geoscientists with a really big mission in his life, educating the world about climate change and some of the things we can do about it. Wally, thank you so much for being with us. I apologize for my very long question. So in very simple terms, is climate change, the acceleration of it, people-induced, or is it just part of a normal cycle? That's such an easy way I could have asked the question.
Well, you know, we know that the CO2 that's building up in the atmosphere is man-made. I think everybody accepts that. It's very hard to make a case that that's not true. Now, one of the problems has been is that climate is varied on its own. And we had what we call the Little Ice Age between about year 1400 and 1850, where the planet was, especially the northern hemisphere, was maybe up to 1 degree centigrade cooler, at least at high latitudes. And we don't really understand, I don't think, you know, what caused that, but it happened. The reason that I inherited this funny title of Father of Global Warming,
which I like.
In 1975, I was puzzled by the fact that between 1940, about the beginning of World War II, and the time that I'm thinking about this, 1975, there had been no appreciable warming. Yet, you know, Charles David Keeling had started in 1958 measuring CO2 very accurately on Hawaii, high elevation site on Hawaii. And, you know, CO2 was going up, so why wasn't it warming? Well, my paper said that this was very likely a natural fluctuation, and that at that time there was some suggestion that the Earth's climate was changing on a 40 and 80, I mean, 180-year time scale, like sort of cyclic.
Okay.
There's no true cycles, but it sort of appeared that way. So in this paper, I said, well, it appears we're from ice core measurements that we're in a cooling period, natural cooling period from 1940 to 1975. And of course, this was being countered by rising CO2. And I said, well, maybe the two just balanced each other out, so we didn't see any change. And I said, if that were the case, then we were in for a pronounced warming. The paper was published in Science, and the words global warming were used in the title, and that's why I got this called the Father of Global Warming.
It really stuck.
And the amazing thing is that my prediction, although in hindsight, it wasn't based on the right stuff, it was right, and in 1976, the warming began, and it's gone on since then. So there was some kind of variation. Maybe I had the wrong thing, but there was something that was opposing global warming, and then in 1976, that turned around and joined global warming, and I think in the last decade, a lot of people are making a big point that it hasn't warmed particularly, is that, you know, we have another flat period. And so instead of temperature of the Earth going up smoothly, it's going to have bumps in it. So sometimes it'll be going up more rapidly, and sometimes it'll be going up more slowly, or maybe even flatten out. So this makes it difficult because people look at that and they say, you know, what does this mean? Well, it means that the Earth on its own had climate cycles. Part of this was heat going in and out of the ocean. Part was volcanic emissions, putting SO2 in the stratosphere and cooling the Earth. There's some suspicion the sun changes its output slightly. But we now know that there's nothing regular about this, and so that's what, you know, I had sort of glommed onto some of the early ice core measurements.
And when it happened, go ahead.
So, you know, it's going to continue, and I think that, you know, it's going to be probably 20 or 30 years before the effects become so totally apparent that people will get scared and want to do something about it. I mean, you know, the Arctic, it's going to be very interesting this summer to see what happens to Arctic sea ice, because last summer it went to an all-time low, and it was a big dip compared to the previous summer. And so we're headed for an open Arctic, and whether that'll happen in 15 years or 50 years, I mean, we can't say, because we can't, that's one of the things we can't predict. But it's going to happen, and that's going to change the weather patterns over North America and Europe. Maybe some of the things we're seeing now are the result of that, but that's impossible to prove, which is another one of our problems. We can't say that if there had been no global warming, there wouldn't have been a Sandy. That's for sure.
When you have a thing like we had the tornado, I mean, a mile wide, everything that I observe seems to be happening bigger and in a more devastating way. And it's just like another little sign, another little knock, knock. Wally, can I ask you about, this is, you know, you in 1976, you wrote about it in 75, 76, what you wrote about started to have a lot of credibility and validity. What happened? Why did Al Gore take the bullet in this? I mean, you and I talked about it a little bit, but that movie, An Inconvenient Truth, first of all, for me, it was really long and had a lot of details, but it was so educational. Everything in that movie he said was true, and it was devastating to him. I mean, I think he was on track for a political career, and he became the brunt of, you know, to say the very least, unkindness from, you know, in the political arena. But what kind of chord did he hit? And why did he create such controversy? Or the movie?
Well, yeah. While he was in the Senate, I testified before his committees a couple times, and he was desperately searching for something that he could use, like the Great Ocean Conveyor was going to stop, or the great flood in Iowa was just a harbinger of you know, much more frequent floods. And I think he did himself some damage by, you know, trying to push it too fast. But, of course, his movie at the time had an enormous impact. But I think, you know, like all of these things, the impact that made has waned.
Like you said, people
and
have Gore short memories.
Now has a foundation, and, you know, as far as I can, I don't really see what he's doing. I mean, I better be careful what I say.
That's not like you. He just has to pump up the volume, so to speak, because his message was important, and I don't know if he got damaged by what happened, but he does have a foundation, and there's need for...
You know, Jim Hansen, who was one of his sort of scientific protege, in a sense, who's been speaking out the strongest of anybody on this subject. He's leery of Gore now, because, you know, Gore has gotten the wrong kind of reputation, and he's no longer a powerful force in this. So I don't think it matters. Some other people are going to have to step to the fore. Gore's time is over. He did what he could. And
he did get attention. You're right. He did.
Yeah,
he did
get
have
attention.
An impact, so. Yeah,
but it's like crying wolf, you know. I mean, we keep saying it's a problem, it's a problem, it's a problem, and it really is a problem. But since it doesn't hit us in the belly on a short time scale, people are willing to put it aside and say we got, you know, more serious problems with our children getting educated and, you know, whatever. And so we can't, you know, put much into this. Plus, people ask me, Wally, what can I do myself? And, well, you know, you can drive a Prius and you can use better light bulbs, and, you know, there are many things you can do, but what we all have to realize is this in itself will never solve the problem. If everybody in the world used a Prius instead of what they're driving now, that might be a 4 or 5% reduction in fossil fuel burning. So, I mean, it would help. That would be good. But
it's
as I said, we've got to have
bucket.
A tenfold reduction in fossil fuel usage. So we've got to have some things that really take big bites out of the problem. We're nibbling now. We're nibbling. And nibbling is good because it helps, but nibbling will never solve the problem.
And we've got to take
and
a big chunk out of it.
That's the tragedy of the whole thing. It's become a CO2 crisis now because people aren't willing to accept that it's going to take, you know, huge, expensive steps to do something about it.
Well, I really would like to talk about one of your, I think it's one of your babies, and it's a complicated, it's not so complicated, but you've written about and worked with Klaus Lackner, Dr. Klaus Lackner, about carbon sequestration, and what does that mean, and the concept of carbon scrubbers. You've made a compelling case for that. I heard you. So let's take this part of the show to talk about why you're advocating for that and why it will help reverse things, because I'm with you in thinking we need drastic times called for drastic measures, and I kind of live in the drastic mode. So let's talk about, first of all, carbon sequestration, because I don't think the average man or woman on the street actually knows what that is.
Well, it's to undo what we've done and doing, and that is that we need some kind of device that the wind blows through that will pull the CO or part of the CO2 out of that passing wind, and that it will hold it on some substance, and then you can take that off and you can actually pressurize it and convert the CO2 into a liquid. And then you can pump it down a pipe into a sandstone, or it would be the reverse of getting oil out of the earth. We'd be putting CO2 back into some geologic strata. There's a big controversy about how much this would cost. Lochner, who I think is the one that knows most about it in the world, thinks it can be done for less than $100 a ton of CO2.
Wow.
Translated to what your listeners can think about, that would be increasing the cost of gasoline 90 cents a gallon. So
wow.
That's affordable.
Yes.
I mean, you know, we could do that, and that would help solar energy and other things because they would get a better opportunity to compete.
And a lot more people would take the bus.
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, no, more people would go to solar and so forth.
Right, right.
If carbon, you know, you put a price on carbon. But other people, there's a paper from some people at MIT saying it cost $1,000 a ton. So that's $9 a gallon. That's impossible. So we could never afford that. The only way to find out what it's actually going to cost is to start doing it on a, you know, pilot scale, so you can, you know, start to get narrow these cost estimates. And Lochner knows how to do it. He has the right material that will, when exposed to the air, will pull CO2 out. If it's then exposed to water, the water kicks the CO2 back off again. And you've got the CO2 in captured form, and you put this stuff back in the air, and the dry air goes through it, kicks off the water, and replaces it with CO2, and it can be done over and over and over again. And so what has to happen is that somebody has to be willing to pay to make prototypes, and so to do a decent preliminary program, you know, this is tens of millions of dollars. So far in this area, in the last 15 years, the total amount of money that's been spent is no more than $25 million. That's what our ne'er-do-well third baseman on the Yankees, you know, makes in a single season.
It's really not funny. It's very
way,
sad. Yeah.
That there's something wrong, you know, that here, the as you say, this is the world's most dangerous environmental problem. I mean, one can think of all kinds of scenarios that could make mega trouble. I mean, you know, and you can also think of scenarios where the trouble will be quite manageable. But we're going into something that we don't understand. And normally, when something like this is, you know, in the offing, we prepare for it. So in any disease or, you know, storms or whatever, we try to prepare for them. But we're not doing that in this case. And so
at all,
you might think that there are many options, but when you think this whole problem through, there are two ways we can go. One is to replace fossil fuel energy with other energy. And as long as fossil fuel energy is cheaper, that's not going to happen. People are not going to pay more for energy just because they have an, you know, environmental conscience, because many of the people want to do this, like the Chinese and Indians, have been traditionally poor, and they're finally getting a better and better life, and that requires burning more and more fossil fuels.
Okay, Wally, so, we have to take another short break, and we'll come back with number two. People don't want to pay for it, and nothing's changing. And let's come back with number two, Dr. Wallace Brecker, leading scientist, and garners the term global warming. Please stay here with me. Lots more good stuff when we get back.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Castle Rock Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
She's the most exciting thing that's ever happened to you, and you want to spend eternity with her. She deserves nothing less than the best, an Abbott Taylor original. A diamond engagement ring as exceptional as she is that will make her eyes sparkle every time she sees it. Because we design and make our own jewelry, we can create something wonderful for every budget. I'm Abbott Taylor. I'd like to invite you to come see what Abbott Taylor Jewelers has waiting for you. With 35 years and thousands of original jewelry designs, no one has more experience in designing and making diamond jewelry in Tucson than Abbott Taylor Jewelers. We're proud to say, using recycled gold, we have saved over 100 million pounds of toxic waste from this planet. Abbott Taylor Jewelers at 6383 East Grant Road, on Facebook, and on the web at atdiamonds.com. Abbott Taylor Jewelers. Diamond designs for everyone. Abbott Taylor Jewelers.
It's got advanced technology. It's got major breakthroughs in technology everywhere you look. It's the 2013 Honda Accord. Hi there, this is Mrs. Green, and I want to share with you that after nearly 40 years of heritage, this is the most stunning Accord ever. The highly respected Automotive Magazine raves that the 2013 Honda Accord offers unparalleled talent of goodness. Please visit Chapman Honda at 4646 East 22nd Street in Tucson to check it out and see for yourself.
Can academic research really save the planet? This year, the University of Arizona took full ownership of Biosphere 2. With five ecosystems enclosed in over 7 million cubic feet of sealed glass, Biosphere 2 is a premier facility for environmental research, where the top minds in the world will come together to address some of humanity's greatest challenges, such as climate change. Now that's using your brains. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Are you thinking about swapping out your old items for new? Think Habitat when you do. Don't trash it. Have a store it. Habitat for Humanity Tucson will resell your donated furniture, appliances, and building supplies and use the proceeds to build affordable homes in the greater Tucson area. Call now at 520-889-7200 for a free pickup. You can bring your donations to Habitat's Habitat Store at 935 West Grant Road, just a quarter mile east of I-10. For more information, go to HabitatTucson.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And if you have been with us since the start of the show, Dr. Wally Brecker is certainly giving us a lot to think about. He is arguably one of the world's greatest living geoscientists with a very big mission in his life, educating the world about climate change and, more importantly, some of the solutions we have in front of us that we are going to have to look at sooner than later. If you ask me, I think it's the most significant issue that we face as a planet. So, Wally, thank you for being here. And let's go to part two. You said part one of the solution is lowering our dependence very quickly on fossil fuels, which I agree with you is not highly likely given the rapid acceleration of fossil fuel burning in China and India and our continued use. What's number two?
Well, it's clear to me that at some point we're going to have to pull CO2 back out of the air. By the time we're weaned off fossil fuels, the CO2 content of the air is going to be well more than double what it was. And I'm guessing that the climate consequences of that are going to be such that people are going to want to bring it back down again. And so if we don't start to pull CO2 back out of the air in the short term and wait until, you know, utopia has arrived, we're then going to want to do it. It has another interesting aspect. If, let's say, we get to a point where we have other sources of energy and can produce hydrogen, there's been talks about, you know, using hydrogen to run automobiles. And the problem with that is no one has found a way to store the hydrogen in a car for, you know, long enough time that, it would vaporize and leave. But if you can pull CO2 out of the air, you can then, for a slight add-on, the price of making the hydrogen, convert it to gasoline by putting CO2 together with hydrogen. You make inorganic gasoline. People in South Africa, Nazi Germany, did that because they were cut off from supplies of fossil fuels. So people know how to do this. So what concerns me is there is this debate about how much it costs, and we should find out how much it costs, because if it is $1,000 a ton, as the MIT people said in their paper, then it's undoable, and we have to cross it off the list. And then we're really in trouble, because what's left is, waiting for that wonderful day when we're weaned off fossil fuels. And, you know, what surprised us after Kyoto was the rapidity with which China and India industrialized. And that's why CO2 production has gone from, I said 1990, it was 20 billion tons a year, up and now it's 32. And that's not going to end, because there are a lot of poor people on the planet who would like to go the way of China and India, and eventually they will. And they will, of course, use the cheapest possible energy, and that's just going to add to the problem. So I think that, we must find that out. Yet you say, well, why don't we find it out? Well, nobody wants to finance it. The U.S. federal government doesn't want to finance it. Industry certainly doesn't want to finance it, because they don't want to make any move that would sort of admit that this is a serious problem. Venture capitalists won't touch it, because it's not going to bring a profit for, a decade or two, and that's you know, they've got to get their money back in time scale of 3 to 5 years. So people who try to get this money have not been able to do it. We're having a meeting this next week on Wednesday and Thursday of a group of people, including Klaus Lochner, who you mentioned, to try to think about a way to jumpstart it. One possibility is to couple it with algal energy production. There's one way to, you know, get energy from plant material. We're right now getting it from corn,
right,
but you could also get it by growing algae in ponds.
Right.
Well, one of the limiting ingredients for those algae is CO2. It won't come in from the atmosphere fast enough, and therefore you couldn't get enough growth. So they want to pump in CO2, and right now they use it from CO2 from power plants, and that sounds like a great idea, except if they ever were able to expand the algal ponds to the size where they could make, you know, a few percent of our energy or 10% of our, and they'd cover huge areas, which would have to be way away from any cities, and therefore they wouldn't have any local source of CO2. And so the idea is to couple it with Lochner's air capture and get started that way. Somehow this whole thing, you have to have some way to make money by pulling it out of the air. Well, that's one possibility. Right now, algal energy costs 4 times more than gasoline energy. So that whole area has a ways to go before they you know, can think that that'll be one of the players.
Well, one of the...
But anyway, we're going to talk about that, and maybe we can start to make some progress. As I said, so far only $25 million has been spent on this, and that's what A-Rod makes in a season.
And I have to say,
LeBron... we got to do something better than that.
We really do. And LeBron James, I think, is right there at about $90 million a year. So you're right. Where are our priorities? It's rather... you know, shocking, appalling, depressing, pejorative, I don't know exactly what word, but it shows where the values are about money, money, money. So let me ask you this, and you kind of touched on it a little bit. So climate change, if it was to become, and at some point I believe it will be, a national security priority, because I mm-hmm. think there are challenges in that arena, the risk to me, I'll be honest, of involving the national security agencies in responding to climate change, would it militarize the issue and create more conflict, or would it be raised then to the level?
No, and I don't want actually, this to be- I think that if the U.S. were to do it, that would be the route it would come by. I think the military has a greater awareness of the possible consequences of all this, and therefore they might be willing to do this, and that's an area we should try. I happen to think that if it's done, probably it'll be the Chinese that do it, because they have the right kind of government to do things like this. They can just say, we want to do it, and they'll do it, and then they, you know, they have the resources and they have the technology and people to do it. But so far, they haven't expressed a big interest. This is all very surprising, because it's not as if we have, you know, other than going to alternate energies, which is, of course, the obvious thing, and that's the goal, but we're just creeping there at a tiny rate. I said that, you know, only 15% of our energy comes from non-fossil
right,
fuel
renewables.
Sources. That was the same when I got into this in the late 1950s. It was 15%. So, I mean, the two have paralleled one another. We're, you know, using more non-fossil fuel sources and also more fossil fuel energy. But the ratio of the two hasn't changed. So we're not making a dent in the problem of going to something like the opposite, where you get 15% of your energy from fossil fuels and 85% from non-fossil fuels.
And if they can figure out how to monetize it, we will have investors standing in line. They just want a good ROI. And that, to me, is really incredibly depressing. And you kind of hit on this, but bringing it back to as we get close to wrapping up, of all of the, is there any one group who can make the greatest difference, the politicians or businesses? Maybe now we want to add in leading sports figures or individuals about shifting it, you know, moving the green needle forward as opposed to the CO2 emissions level forward. Where, in your opinion, can we put our focus to make the greatest difference? Because I agree with you. I don't think there's anything more important than people paying attention to climate change. Of all the guests I interview with great messages and great solutions to some problems, climate change is the place from which all others come.
Yeah, we can see that New York, Bloomberg just proposed $20 billion worth of things that would protect us from Sandy-like events. And, you know, when you start talking that kind of money for individual cities, you start to see, you know, how expensive this whole thing could be.
And also that somebody's paying attention.
By the way, there's one thing that I would like to mention, which is the third way. We said decreasing dependence on fossil fuels, recapturing CO2 from the air and burying it. There is another one which is going to rear its ugly head, and that is that for 10% of the cost of capturing and burying CO2, you could put SO2 in the stratosphere, and it would make sulfuric acid aerosols, which would reflect away sunlight. And that's very doable, but it would mean we start to interfere with weather on a very large, you know, planetary scale. And, you know, I would hope that this is never done, but, you know, we're painting ourselves into a corner by doing nothing and let CO2 increase and increase and increase. Eventually, somebody may say, well, we have to cool the planet off on a short time scale. We can't possibly pull all that CO2 back on a short time scale. It would take, you know, decades. But we could put SO2 in the stratosphere and get immediate relief. So that's hanging out there, and, you know, I probably won't be around when it becomes a major issue, but it's something to think about, that there are ways to manipulate the reflectivity of the planet to compensate for the extra heating. Doubling CO2 is like cranking up the sun 2% in its energy output. And so if you could reflect away 2% of the sunlight, in the sense on the average for the whole planet, that would compensate for doubling CO2. But, you know, it would have all kinds of consequences that we can't predict. And that's
scary. I mean, it really is scary. Yeah. We don't
but
really
it's
know
there,
what's
and
it's there.
It's well known. And the price is, you know, can easily determined. You just gotta. We did this once in the 80s and said to get enough up there to each, you have to put it up every year because it comes back down again. And it would cost about $20 billion a year for the SO2 and about, at that time, $20 billion a year for the airplanes to fly it up high in the stratosphere and dump it. So, you know, that's now that may be tripled. Let's say that it's going to be $120 billion. But solving the CO2 problem is a trillion-dollar, you know, problem. So that is an ugly thing, which is sitting there. And, you know, since you said money talks. And so, you know, when it gets down to the nitty-gritty, there's going to be a huge temptation to do that. And we may have to, and that would be an interim thing to cool a planet while we pulled the CO2 back down again, or, you know, got off
so
of fossil fuel.
Wally, we have to end on that note. There are going to be people listening to this podcast all over the world. Thank you so much for being such a great friend to the planet, and I mean that. Thanks for all the work you do. Mrs. Green's World next week, Kirsten Block and her daughter Rebecca, Buffalo Exchange, one of the largest resale companies in the USA.